Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you're probably familiar with the unique life of my guest today, even though you may not know his name. He's one of the most famous imposters ever. As a young man, between the ages of 16 and 21 years old, Frank Abagnale Jr. successfully forged millions of dollars worth of checks while posing as a Pan Am pilot, a doctor, and a legal prosecutor, among other false identities. His best-selling book, Catch Me If You Can, was made into the 2002 Oscar-nominated movie of the same name, directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Leonardo DiCaprio as Abagnale, also starring Tom Hanks as a seasoned and dedicated FBI agent pursuing him and being tricked by him.
Step out of the bathroom! Hands on your head.
Oh, that's the new IBM Selectric.
Put your hands on your head.
A print type in 5 seconds.
Shut up!
Pop out the ball.
Put your hands on your head! Put your hands!
You know, he's got over 200 checks here.
Hands on your head!
Drafting. He even has little payroll envelopes addressed to himself.
Put it down. Drop it!
Relax. You're late, all right? My name's Allen, Barry Allen, United States Secret Service. Your boy just tried to jump out the window. My partner has him in custody.
I don't know what you're talking about.
What, you think the FBI are the only ones on this guy? I mean, come on. Come on, he's dabbling in government checks here. I've been following a paper trail on this guy for months now. Hey, you mind taking that gun out of my face? Please, really. It makes me nervous.
Catch Me If You Can, came out in 2002, Oscar-nominated. There, Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hanks playing in the lead roles. For the past 40 years, Frank Abagnale has been on the right side of the law, serving as a consultant to the FBI. He's written 3 books on the subject of identity theft. Thousands of financial institutions, corporations, law enforcement agencies use his fraud prevention programs. And since 2015, he's been the AARP's Fraud Watch Ambassador, advising individuals how they can protect themselves from financial exploitation. He joins me this hour from Des Moines by phone. Frank Abagnale, a big welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're in Iowa today as we speak as the AARP's Fraud Watch Ambassador. I understand you've got some outreach events. They are all full, I'm told. But tell us, what are the key messages you give to retired people about financial exploitation?
Well, you know, I've spent my entire career dealing with crimes against governments, financial institutions, corporations, and banks. And a few years ago, AARP approached me and said, I know that you write a lot about consumer crimes, but we would like to take you on tour, bring you around the country to 9 or 10 cities a year, and let you speak directly to consumers, not just elderly people, but it's free for anyone to come. You don't have to be an AARP member to learn about all the scams that are currently going on. Obviously, my entire career, I've realized that education is the most powerful tool to fighting crime. So if you can explain to someone how these scams work and what they should do when they get that call or that email or that letter, then they're smart enough to be able to take action and do that. Fortunately, the majority of people are honest, and because they're honest, they don't think with a deceptive mind. So when the phone rings and they walk over the caller ID and it says Des Moines Police Department, they believe it's the Des Moines Police Department, but they don't understand that caller ID is easily able to fix it to say whatever you want it to say.
Mm-hmm. What are the current newest scams that are taking people these days?
Keep in mind that all scams, whether we're in Italy or in the United States, they're the same scams that were perpetrated 50 years ago. There's just a different way of delivering them today. So the two most common ones we hear about at AARP, and they have 40 million members, so we get a lot of good input from people all over the country. One is the grandfather scam, and that is the call where you go over to the caller ID. It says Des Moines Police Department, so you pick the call up. It says, this is Sergeant Ryan with the Des Moines Police. We arrested your grandson. They tell you the grandson's name. For DWI, he was driving this vehicle on this interstate. He had one passenger, and they give you his girlfriend's name, and they say he had one phone call. He asked us not to call his parents, but to call you. If he doesn't post bail in the next 2 hours, he will have to spend the weekend in jail. And people go, well, how much is the bail? $500, and you can use a credit card and give me the card number, and we can post as bail. And it's amazing, unfortunately, how many people fall for that.
Mm-hmm. Are older people generally easier to con than younger?
Not necessarily. We at AARP, we did a survey of 10,000 people just a couple years ago and partnered with Microsoft to do it. And we found that many millennials were the ones that were falling for all these computer scams to fix their computer with false emails about they had ransomware and have to need to get in your computer and fix it. And so we find that, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. Anyone can be, I myself can be scammed. Anybody can be scammed. Of course, it's nothing to be ashamed of. The smartest people in the world get scammed. But I don't think that it's just the elderly. And it's very interesting to me when we go do these events, and you have 1,000 people coming in, and you look at, you're standing in the lobby, and you notice that a lot of these people are maybe 30, 40 years old, some younger, and you ask them why are you here, and sometimes they say, I'm here because I want to be able to protect my parents who are elderly, or they say, I'm worried about my own identity and someone getting into my bank account and stealing from me. So I think it's all walks of life that people have a concern about fraud.
Join our conversation today, a live conversation with Frank Abagnale about his life, also about fraud and identity theft. He's been talking about the AARP and types of fraud that is perpetrated against retired people, especially. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Well, you're in the part of the country where we are typically described, Frank, as trusting, perhaps also naive to cons. Are Midwesterners, do you think, easier to con because we are generally known as a trusting people?
Not necessarily. And for those of people that don't know, I have three sons. I raised them in the same house in Tulsa, Oklahoma for 25 years. My oldest boy went to University of Kansas. I like to consider myself, even though I was born in New York, I like to consider myself a Midwesterner. And I believe that people, and basically, as I mentioned earlier, are trusting by nature, but also they believe what they hear, and they don't have a deceptive mind. So they don't sit there and think, well, how could this be a scam? They know all this information, so this must be legitimate. And if I gave them this information, what could they possibly do with it? And that's why it's such importance to provide an educational program to be able to do that.
I guess I'm a little surprised that you can't seem to identify a group that would be more gullible than another in a geographical sense or age sense or any sense. Don't you look at it that way?
I don't look at it that way because I guess after 40-plus years of doing this, I find that everyone can be scammed, no matter from the most intelligent people on Wall Street to the most sophisticated bankers to obviously the people who fall for investment scams that consider themselves savvy investors. Right down to the elderly and young people who get scammed, even kids in college who answer all these solicitations that come on the phone and say, well, this is Visa, we're going to send you a credit card, or I don't have a job, I'm just a student. Doesn't matter, it has a $300 limit, and you can get the card, but I need to get all the information from you, name, Social Security, date of birth, etc. I mean, even they fall for it because, again, they haven't been told any different.
Okay. Is there a difference between men and women, gender?
I don't really think so. I think women may be a little more questionable than men. They're not as impulsive. I think they tend to maybe think it out a little more. But obviously, I think they can be victimized just like anybody else.
Talking to Frank Abagnale, former imposter, fraudster, author of Catch Me If You Can, made into a movie of the same name starring Leonardo DiCaprio. Let me ask you at this point, as I kind of remind our audience, Frank, who you are. You have so many different monikers, one of them the greatest con man of all time. What do you prefer to be called with your criminal background?
I kind of have to always smile, and I know that I'm called that every single day, all the time. And, you know, everything I did between the ages of 16 and 21. I was just a teenager through most of it. So, you know, and the total dollar amount, which was a lot of money back then, was $2.5 million, but they recovered more than $2 million of the money. And you look about people today, politicians, people that swindle people out of $50 million, $3 billion, They're obviously a lot greater con men than me, both in political life and both in business, but I always get a kick out of referring to me, something I did 50 years ago, as being the world's greatest con man.
So what is the way you, the shorthand way you like to be labeled?
You know, I have no problem. Obviously, I did the things I did. I take responsibility for them. I would prefer people say former con man or former confidence man. Obviously, it's been a long time ago that happened. You know, and the work, of course, I've worked with the FBI for 41 years now. I've taught at the Academy for 41 years. You know, I've worked for some of the biggest corporations in the world. I think I've come a long way since that 16-year-old boy some 50 years ago.
All right. Frank, we're talking on a day when the story of the massive data breach at Equifax, one of the nation's three major credit card reporting companies, is still developing. The news out, it may be even larger than originally thought, according to a cybersecurity firm. As it stands, almost 150 million U.S. consumers had their Social Security numbers, other sensitive information exposed. What's your reaction to this data breach?
Well, two things. First of all, it's a very serious breach because if we go back to all the breaches going back, last year we had 1,206 breaches amounting to 1.7 billion identities being stolen. We have to add two more because in the last couple of weeks we found out about a breach at the SEC, a breach at Deloitte, the accounting firm. So these breaches occur all the time, but the problem you have is many of these breaches deal with credit card information, debit card information such as Target, Home Depot, TJ Maxx, etc. And those really are simply something that has a very short lifespan. You have to use it right away, you have to get rid of it right away, and of course the consumer by law has no liability, so the consumer's not out any money from those breaches. Here in the case of Equifax, we have someone that's taken your name, your Social Security number, and your date of birth. You can't change your name. You can't change your Social Security number. You can't change your date of birth. So this type of data is warehoused, and they keep it for 2 to 3 years before they ever even go out and start to use it, sell it. So when Equifax comes along and says, I'm going to give you 1 year of credit monitoring service for free, that's worthless because absolutely nothing will happen with that data for at least 2 or 3 years down the road before it comes out in the marketplace. And it's almost a little bit kind of like a scam on their part because they're going to sign up millions of people who are very concerned and scared. They're going to get this free credit monitoring. And then in a year from now, they're going to say, well, the data hasn't showed up yet. You should renew, and you have to renew at $20 a month. So they're going to sign up millions of people. It's going to become a profitable thing for them to do. So I have a real problem with that. And to be honest with you, I do use a credit monitoring service, but I've always had one. But if I was going to go buy one tomorrow because of that breach, the last place I'm going is back to Equifax because they've already shown me that I can't trust them with my data, so I'm not going to give them more data about me. So I would find another credit monitoring company to do that if I had to do that.
Mm-hmm. The way you describe it, it does sound like it could be seen as a scam. I mean, you work for the government, advising people. Certainly, your name means a lot. Shouldn't there be sort of a legislative remedy for this so that Equifax can't just cash in on all these new contacts?
Absolutely, and somebody should be doing that. I don't know if anybody, Congress or someone in Washington is looking at that. Obviously, we've discussed that. Doesn't take a genius to understand that it's kind of a marketing ploy, and that in the end, people are going to all sign up for that service. The whole thing is that one thing I've learned in this 40 years and all the breaches getting back to TJ Maxx some 15 years ago, every breach occurs because somebody in that company did something they weren't supposed to do, or somebody in that company failed to do something they were supposed to do. Hackers do not cause breaches. People do. So when you look at every breach, it turns out someone took a laptop they weren't supposed to take home. Someone, in the case of Equifax, didn't keep up with the current patches they were required to keep up with. We have the infrastructure and the technology to keep hackers out, but you have to use it. Technology is only as good is when you use it. But you take even a big bank, like a New York bank that employs 200,000 people, they can have the best infrastructure in the world, the best technology in the world, but they still have to rely on making sure that that employee does not make a mistake or do something they're not supposed to do. As I tell people all the time, There is no technology. There never will be any technology to stop social engineering. You only stop social engineering through education. So it is smart for companies to educate their people about how to make sure they keep this information safe. That's their most important job. And then to also make sure, just like you do at home, if Microsoft sends you a patch, says you need to install this, we install it because we're updating the security in our computer. And that's the same thing every company should be doing, especially when they've been entrusted with somebody else's information.
If you just joined us, Frank Abagnale is my guest this hour, former con man, confidence man, the author of Catch Me If You Can, was played by Leonardo DiCaprio in that Oscar-nominated movie from 2002. Join our conversation with your questions for Frank Abagnale, 1-866-780-9100. rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. Joe is joining us from Iowa City. Hi, Joe. What's your question for Frank?
Really, a bunch of what goes on with the phone scams. They're calling in. They leave no message. And now they've gotten so good that I've gotten a 000 number. I've gotten phone calls to myself. And it's taught us not to answer our phones anymore. The phone company won't do anything about it. You can only block 25 at a time. I'd rather get about a block, 1,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting really smart. So what's going on there?
Great question,
yeah,
Joe.
Yeah, these robocalls, and keep in mind that these calls come from all over the world, from Russia, from China, from India, from Malaysia, from thousands of miles away. These robocalls are a sophisticated software. So I always remind people that if I answer the phone and I start to listen to their pitch and I stay on and listen to it, or I do prompts on my phone to answer their questions, then I'm making myself a target because they just resell that on the dark web, those numbers, to somebody else. If I pick up my phone and the minute they say this is the IRS or this is some scam I'm familiar with and I hang my phone up within a few seconds, they're most likely not to keep calling me. They tend to call people over and over because they get people on the phone. They listen to their pitch, or they think they're going to outsmart them and say something. And that's not what you want to do. When you pick it up, recognize who it is. If it's not somebody you want to talk to, just hang up the phone as quickly as you can, and you'll find that eventually they'll stop ringing your phone.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of people, I think there was a podcast I listened to recently, Frank, where someone just played with these people. They got entertainment from getting these fraudulent calls, but then just sort of wasting their time leading them down a road.
That's absolutely.
Don't do that either.
Don't do that.
Tell us, scamming then and now, you were a con man in the 50s, right?
In the late 60s.
Has it gotten easier to be a con man than it used to be?
Well, this is what it is. Crime has gotten 4,000 times easier than when I did it because of technology. Technology breeds crime. It always has, and it always will. So there's always going to be individuals who use technology in a negative, self-serving way. So when the example would be when I printed checks, I needed a printing press. Today, you sit down at your laptop, you design a check, you capture a corporate logo off the website, and the bank's logo off their website, and you make a beautiful check in 5 minutes, and you print it out on check paper you bought at an office supply store on your inkjet printer, and you got a beautiful check. So technology has made it a lot easier. It certainly made it more global. Most of these criminals are not even in the country. They're outside the country, so it makes it very difficult to arrest them, prosecute them, and pursue them. But as far as the con man goes, the day of the old confidence man, and that would be the guy who was the very well-dressed, very well-spoken, had a great vocabulary, had a nice appearance, nice manners. And he was a confidence man. That's the name con man because he gained people's confidence. The difference today is you don't ever see that person, and they never see you. The victim never sees who's going to rip them off, and the person who's ripping them off will never see the victim, which makes it a lot easier for the person who's ripping them off because they're thousands of miles away. So the computer and the internet has really done away with the whole need for the con man. There are still obviously con men out there, but that whole thing of con men has kind of gone away and been replaced because of the internet.
Mm-hmm. And so your voice alone, the way you behave on the phone, your voice sounds, is your suit and tie.
That's it. I might be in my pajamas with a cup of coffee in Moscow in my kitchen on a laptop.
All right. Join our conversation this hour with Frank Abagnale. Coming up on a break, 1-866-780-9100. Time enough, though, to talk with Alma, Alma of Iowa City. Hi, Alma.
Hi.
Something happened to you that you want to share?
Well, it's absolutely, and he just spoke about it, was I received a, a package, flat package in the mail about 2 weeks ago. And just like our con man said, I received a check for $1,680. And I started looking at the check, and this person wanted me to go to Walmart. Well, first he wanted me to deposit the check in my account and wait a couple of days for it to go through, and then go to Walmart, buy myself something for $50, keep $300 of it, and send him a money order for the remaining $1,300. And I started looking at the check, and across the top of the check, it said Prestige Car Service, Incorporated, out of New York, out of Bronx. And so I looked it up on the internet, and sure enough, there is a company in New York called Prestige Car Service.
Mm-hmm.
And on this check, they spelled service, S-E-R-V-I-S-E.
Coming up on a break. Quickly, Alma, what's the end?
So I called the Attorney General and reported them to the Attorney General office here in Iowa and actually called this company and spoke to them to try to find out exactly, do you have a survey, shopping survey? And they said no. And so I didn't. And then when I went onto the website, this website that it directed me to wanted my Social Security number. And I'm like, no way am I giving you my Social Security number. And then last week, I received a phone message, text message from this fella asking me why I hadn't cashed the check yet.
Okay.
And I did not respond. So people have to be careful.
Okay.
I mean, it's out there.
Frank, we've got to go away in about a minute. What do you think of Alma's the fraud she encountered?
I want her to know that I personally have gotten at least three or four of those checks. They come priority mail or FedEx. I've even had them sent to the FBI office in my name. Some of them said Bosch and Lomb. Some said very hot, very well known. They're all always $1,600, $1,200. There are a lot of scams based around that. Sometimes you just deposit it. Then a couple of days later, they contact you and say that it was sent to you by mistake and that they need you to wire them back the money. But because of the trouble they caused you, keep $200 of the money. People go to the bank and they wire the money. Then eventually the check comes back as a fraudulent check. So there are a lot of scams. No one's going to, and it always comes in an envelope by itself, nothing with it, no letter. If you get that, just rip it up and don't do anything with that.
Frank Abagnale, please stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with Frank Abagnale, former confidence man of Catch Me If You Can fame. When we come back, we'll ask Frank about the future of cybercrime. Also talk about his transition from coming out of prison in his mid-20s to working for the government. He's been working for the FBI for some 40 years. We'll have him explain that arrangement. Also answer your questions, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Frank Abagnale. He's in Iowa working with the AARP. He is the AARP's Fraud Watch Ambassador. As a young man, Frank successfully forged millions of dollars worth of checks, posed as a Pan Am pilot, a doctor, a legal prosecutor, among other false identities. The best-selling book of his, Catch Me If You Can, was made into the 2002 Oscar-nominated movie of the same name, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. Today, Abagnale consults with the U.S. government on identity theft and fraud prevention. Here's Leonardo DiCaprio playing Abagnale, being asked for his expertise in the difference between counterfeit and real checks.
I'd like you to take a look at something for me. Tell me what you think.
That's a fake.
How do you know? You haven't looked at it.
Well, there's no perforated edge, right? I mean, this check was hand cut, not fed. Yeah. Paper's double bonded, much too heavy to be a bank check. magnetic ink. It's raised against my fingers instead of flat. This doesn't smell like Micker. It's some kind of a, you know, some kind of a drafting ink. You know, the kind you get at a stationery store.
Frank, would you be interested in working with the FBI's Financial Crimes Unit?
I already got a job here. You know, I deliver the mail.
Frank, we have the power to take you out of prison. You'd be placed in the custody of the FBI, where you'd serve out the remainder of your sentence as an employee of the federal government.
It's an excerpt from the 2002 award-winning movie Catch Me If You Can. Frank Abagnale, explain. You were in your 20s. You got out of prison. It began helping the U.S. government. How did that arrangement happen?
Yeah, so people understand, I was arrested actually when I was 21 by the French police in France. They charged me with forgery and sent me to French prison. When my prison term was up in France, I was extradited to Sweden. They charged me with forgery and sent me to Swedish prison. When my prison term was up in Sweden, U.S. federal authorities took custody of me, returned me to the United States, and a United States federal judge in Atlanta, Georgia, sentenced me to 12 years in federal prison. I served four of those 12 years at a federal prison in Petersburg, Virginia. When I was 26 years old, the government offered to take me out of prison on the condition I go to work with an agency of the government for the remainder of my sentence or until my parole had been satisfactorily completed. And that's exactly what I did. I have actually been at the FBI 32 years past that federal court order and have stayed there for 41 years, and a very proud father of a son who is an FBI agent celebrating 12 years in the Bureau himself. So it was an amazing opportunity for me to do something to pay back my debt, and that's something I didn't want to leave even after my time was up to leave, so that's still what I do today at age 69.
Don is calling from Lake Rapids for Frank Abagnale. Hi, Don. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Frank, you answered a lot of my questions. I wanted to say to you, yeah, and you are Midwestern, the way a guy with your credentials, intelligence, to turn from crime, which you, I don't even know how you did it. You might want to explain how you, you know, at your young age, how you were able to do this. But, and then you went the straight and narrow way, and you raised three kids and Soonerville, which I believe the Cyclones play this weekend. But I think that's, yeah, it just, you're an inspiration to people that you can change. And even a guy as smart as you are, with your, yeah, hey, you can go the right way, and I'm real proud of you, Frank. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Don.
I certainly appreciate that, and I know that people are very fascinated by what I did between 16 and 21, but to be honest with you, at 69, I look back on my life. What is most amazing to me is that what happened after that. I've been married to my one and only wife for 40-plus years. I've raised three great sons, a grandfather of five children. I've served my country for 40 years. I've done a lot of positive things with my life, but only because I live in America, where everyone can make a mistake and you have the opportunity to get up, brush yourself off, and start all over again. Even if what's the most amazing day of my life is when my son became an FBI agent. So you're not judged by your father or anybody else. You're judged by yourself as an individual, and we live in a great country, and I think people sometimes forget that.
Frank, does your son, as an FBI agent, ever come to you for advice? Sort of what would walk you through a case he's on and get your thoughts?
Yeah, actually, I taught my son at the FBI Academy, like I have some three generations of agents that gone through the academy. And my son worked as a counterintelligence agent for part of his career. Then he was a supervisor over an espionage squad in the Baltimore field office. And now he is a supervisor over the Crisis Negotiations Unit out of Quantico, and that's a response team which deals with Americans kidnapped overseas. But we've gotten to be able to talk about cases, especially when he was doing espionage cases, about how people were moving money laundering money, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Does being a former con man, while you were a con man, in your early 20s, could you identify other confidence men easily?
Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, I think that I got away with so many of the things I got away with, not because I was brilliant, but because of the fact that I was an adolescent. I had no fear of being caught. I really didn't think about all the consequences. And I didn't sit out in front of a bank with a $500 check and say, I'm going to go in this bank and cash this check. If they say this, I'll do this. If they do this, I'll do that. I just went in and did it. And that was the young kid in me. I always felt that if I'd been a little older, maybe 25, 26, I wouldn't have done half the things I did because I would have rationalized that they're not going to work. It's not going to happen. I just thought you could do anything as a young kid does, and I went at it and did it. But I also had the ability to observe things that other people don't see, to find weaknesses in things people probably don't see weaknesses in. And I have spent, I've had the opportunity in my career now to work with two great technologies. One's called TrueSona, and one was called the 41st Parameter. They're used all over the world now, but I worked as a consultant to those technology companies. And as the CEO explained to someone once, he said, you know, Frank Abagnale doesn't write code, but I'm not a criminal. So I can write all the software in the world, but I need him to tell me where its weaknesses are. So he and I kind of play chess. I say, I made this, and he comes back and says, well, I could circumvent that by doing this. Then I go back and fix it, and he said, well, I put up this firewall. Well, I could get around that by doing this. And he said, only with someone with his mind could figure those things out. No matter how smart I am, I could never do that. And so I think that's how I've been able to use a lot of what I do today.
Mm-hmm. It seems like your experience as a former con man would give you some special insights into our new era of fake news. After all, the fake news is aimed with a purpose and meant to con us, right?
Right. And I'll be honest with you, that's one of the scariest things to me, because I don't know how then we're any different than Russia or China, where they put out fake news every day to serve their government. When you start getting into all this political stuff and you're going to start telling me the news based on your biased beliefs about something, that's a long way from Walter Cronkite and a long way from the news that I grew up as a kid listening to. And it gets very scary, because if I can manipulate the news and tell you something that's not accurate, or tell you something and kind of change the story a little bit, people rely on the news. They rely on listening to the radio. They rely on watching television and listening to the news. And they're expecting them to tell them the truth, not so much their opinion, but to give them the facts about what happened. And I tell you, it gets very scary when we start to go down this road where we start to manipulate, whether through social media sites or whether through the news, and start to put out fake news. That gets very scary.
Join our conversation with Frank Abagnale, former con man. Catch Me If You Can. His book, made into a movie in 2002, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. We have him for a few more minutes. He's in the state working with AARP as its Fraud Watch ambassador. Let's go to Eric. Eric in Burlington. Hi, Eric. Eric, are you there? Eric does not seem to be there. Okay, we'll try another. Let's go to Des Moines. Ben, are you there in Des Moines?
I am.
Very good. We're hearing you loud and clear. Go ahead, please.
Frank, I'm a computer engineer, and one of my focuses is on information assurance, which is a fancy way of saying security. And my impression is that most companies that I've worked for, but not all, most of them really do not take security very seriously at all. They play lip service to it. They have big overarching efforts, especially around their data. But they don't perform security audits of their software very well. They don't do penetration testing very well, et cetera. And this Equifax breach was bad, but my impression is that it's just the tip of the iceberg for what's to come. So my question for you is, what do you think we should do to prevent this?
Ben, I'm in 100% agreement with you, and in so many realms of cyber. But one, I believe that you have to hold companies responsible. If I entrust you with my information and you, through your negligence, not something you couldn't help happen, but through your own negligence, you caused me to have my information stolen and then used against me, there should be the right of recourse for me to sue. These companies have got to start getting much smarter about protecting the information they've been entrusted with. If you go in a typical doctor's office, that information's in an unlocked file cabinet. Any janitor I could bribe to get information, take a photo of your Social Security number, your date of birth. There's very little security, even in companies where you think there is security. And this is the same way when we manufacture devices, whether it be remote debit capture so you can scan your check and put it in your bank, or whether it's a device in your house where you can talk to Siri and say, hey, order me this from Amazon. Did someone ask a question, can you reverse that so they can hear everything you're saying in your house? And you can. We have so many weak points in our house when we look at our televisions, our remote controls, our cameras, because they've been designed only to get them out into the marketplace without someone stopping to think through and say, how would someone do this in a negative way? And all I'm saying is that when you develop a product that's a sensitive product involving technology, you have to stop and say, okay, this is great, but now how would someone use it against my client or customer or the person buying this device? And that's what they don't do. And I'll give you a little idea. October is Cyber Awareness Month. So for years, I used to go out and speak to Fortune 500 companies. Literally 5 days a week, I was in a Fortune 500 company speaking to their employees about the importance of keeping information safe. So I had a little thing I did. When I pulled into the parking lot, I didn't park in the visitor parking lot. I parked in the company employee parking lot. And when I got out of the car, I emptied my pockets of these memory sticks that I threw on the ground that all said confidential. And I had a tracing device on them. So by lunchtime, I could go in their cafeteria, open my laptop, and tell you how many employees picked that up, stuck it in the computer at work to see what it said. And I went on to explain to them that that could have been devastating. I could have cost their company $1 billion overnight in their shares. I could have destroyed their company's brand that they had for 100 years. So you have to bring home the point to people that whether you're the janitor or you're the CEO, you have to understand that the most important job you have is keeping that information safe. And that means doing those audits, updating your software, making sure everything is working correctly, constantly monitoring it. You're absolutely right. That's what's not being done, and that's why we have the issues we have.
Mm-hmm. Going back to what you just said there, Frank, about Siri, we also have these very hot devices, Google Home and Amazon Echo, where you they're your little
right.
your slaves at home.
Right.
You know, what's the weather like,
right.
Alexa or whatever. But you're saying you wouldn't have one of those in your home?
No, because you can simply manipulate that without a lot of effort and reverse it so that I hear everything you're saying in your home. I mean, it actually does hear you because when you first talk to it, that it's hearing what you say.
Mm-hmm.
But you can expand that so that every conversation you're having with your wife or anything where near that device, I can hear. And so, you know, a lot of these things shouldn't be because they should be designed not to allow those things to happen. And whether they're done that way purposely or whether they're done that way because they're not taking the time to do it, I just think companies have to put a little more thought into the security. And we are going to have a lot more breaches, and we're going to have a lot more problems with cyber. We're just at the tip of the iceberg with that.
When we talk about the future of cybercrime, will it also be used for things other than financial gain or stealing data? Perhaps it is now.
Absolutely. I believe that in the next 5 years, it's going to turn very black. If so, for now, it has been used to gain money, gain data, a financial crime. But we have the ability now to shut someone's pacemaker off, but we have to be within 35 feet of them. So if we're walking down the street and we have the device, we can shut their pacemaker off, speed it up, shut it down. I believe in 5 years, you'll be able to do that from 5,000 miles away. We have the ability in a high-speed chase to get within 35 feet of a vehicle and take over the vehicle by locking the doors, locking the windows, shutting off the engine, turning on the airbag. But I believe in 5 years, you'll be able to do that from thousands of miles away. So I see cyber getting a little black where it becomes a threat to our infrastructure, our banking system, our electrical grid, and of course become a threat to someone's actual life. So we talk about our infrastructure and our electrical grid. And we're nowhere further along than we were 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Frank, if apart from the financial payoff, How much of a thrill did you get from posing as someone you weren't, or passing a counterfeit check and having someone fall for it?
Yeah, you know, there was never really the thrill. The whole thing started out as more survival. I ended up on the street 16 years old in New York City with no money. And, of course, that was back when a lot of kids ran away from home, but they got into Haight-Ashbury and the hippie scene, the drug scene. And I started asking myself, how am I going to survive? So I knew that no one was going to deal with a 16-year-old, so I altered my date of birth on my driver's license to make myself 10 years older. And one thing led to another. I started writing checks as a way of having money to survive on. Then people started chasing me, and I started doing things to stay ahead of the people chasing me. But I don't know that I ever really got a kick out of, you know, I know people like to hear me say that, but I don't think I ever walked out and said, I got a kick. I was kind of the opposite. I was thinking like a kid. And I always tell people, had I walked into a dry cleaner and no one was at the desk and I happened to look over and the cash register was open and there was cash in it, I wouldn't have taken it, because in my mind as a kid, I thought, well, that's stealing. Some mom and pop own this store. They're going to lose this money. When I sat out in front of a bank in New York, I said to myself, this bank has billions of dollars. If I go in and cash a $500 check, it's not going to change anything. They're not going to really miss the money, which was the thinking of an adolescent. It was wrong, but it was the thinking of an adolescent. But as I grew a little older and became 18, 19, and I went in that bank and convinced the teller to cash a check he or she should have not cashed, then I started to have guilt feelings saying, well, I hope this teller doesn't lose their job. I hope I didn't get them in trouble. So, you know, my conscience as I got older started to bother me, and I started to look at it more as an adult. So it was all a matter of a lot of that growing up. But I don't ever recall me walking away and go, ah, those suckers, I got that. I never really felt that about it. It was all about justifying in my mind that I needed this to go on.
Mm-hmm. It seems by and large you saw your crimes in fraud and so forth as an imposter, as a victimless crime, but you just named a potential victim in that bank teller. Did you ever seek out people you had perhaps caused a great deal of harm to inadvertently?
Well, of course, as you know, all the money that I stole has all been paid back. First of all, the government recovered about, I was a young kid, so there was no way I had spending all that money. So the government recovered about $2 million of that money, but about $500,000 of that money I paid back some 20 years ago just off of working and profits from books and things that I've done. I paid that back. I didn't really need to pay it back. There was no legal obligation of restitution in my court order. However, I had three sons, and I know that they knew I could afford to pay it back. I knew that they'd expected me to pay it back, and I did. And, of course, I've run into people, obviously, because of the movie and all that, and since then, but there was really not a lot of people have been very good. There's really not a lot of animosity, or did anyone ever come up to me and be really mad about what I did? But I do understand this, and I'll share this with you. You know, there were people who, when the FBI told them who I really was and all of that, these people were really mad. And the conversation they would have is say, look, he didn't steal anything from me. He didn't cheat me out of anything. On the contrary, he spent a lot of money on me. He bought me gifts. He took me out. He did things with me. He helped me out a little bit financially. But the fact that he didn't trust me, the fact that he constantly deceived me and told me that he was somebody he wasn't, that's what bothers me the most. And that's why, you know, I wash my hands of him. So I think people are even more sensitive than being deceived than they are about you actually stealing from them.
Mm. Got just over a minute left, Frank. Let me try to put you in a criminal mindset. Let's put you in your 20s, but
okay.
it's today, and you are as you were in your 20s. What sort of fraud or deception would most appeal to you that we have on hand today?
I think the ability to commit a crime from thousands of miles away, to do something where they would have no ability to come and get you, arrest you, and you know that reverses. We always talk about Russia, China, but it works the same way here. American criminals committing crimes overseas in Europe and other places, but through technology, so they don't have to worry about being apprehended or prosecuted and caught. I think I'd be looking at ways of how could I do things, but do them from thousands of miles away.
Kind of loses the romantic picture of it, doesn't it, when you don't have to get dressed up and play the part?
Exactly.
It does. All right. Frank, how long are you staying in Iowa?
Just here for today, but we're going to do a lot, and we're going to have a bunch of people tonight. We're going to get the message out to as many people as we can. I would share one quick thing with you. About in the early 80s, I came to Des Moines. I've been to Des Moines many times since then, but in the early 80s, I came to Des Moines to film some public service ads for the Department of Justice, and the Des Moines Police Department is the one we assisted us in filming those ads. We shot them at the airport and around the city, and it was a project with the Des Moines Police Department. Some of the funds from it we gave to the Explorer Club of the Police Department. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting today, there are no public service ads. There are no bank statement stuffers giving people tips. So this is why the ARP really appeals to me, that you can actually reach people that you years ago you reached with public service messages you don't see today. So it's okay. A great opportunity.
Thank you for spending the hour with us, Frank Abagnale. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks, Ben.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.